Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Don Peek. Don, how are you doing?
Thank goodness I woke up again this morning.
Anyway, Don was here before, and we talked a little bit about his career. He's done a lot of different things, and I'm just going to briefly highlight a couple of them, which really made a big impression on me, besides the fact that he was part of the Wrecking Crew, besides the fact that he was hired as a contract musician for Motown, played on almost all of the Jackson 5 and a bunch of the Motown hits. He basically helped us define the Motown sound. So that's another thing that he did. But also, which really impressed me, he did the arrangement for If I Were a Carpenter, right?
Bobby Darin.
And I got that right because I messed it up last time. Anyway, and he was, besides being, so he's on the Wrecking Crew, he was part of the Motown thing. He toured for many years with Ray Charles, and we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. And he also scored all of the series of Knight Rider, all the music for Knight Rider, and has done several film scores. And so he's done a little bit of everything. But tonight, we're going to go a little more specific and in-depth of what he was doing in terms of mainly the session playing. I want to talk a little bit about the Motown sound, and hopefully we'll be able to break it down and give you an idea of how to do it. And a little bit later, we're going to talk about his big band adventures and how to play guitar for big band. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play a clip of the Jackson 5. This is an edit of a couple of segments in the song "I Want You Back," but you can hear the guitar, the whole rhythm section, and then we'll talk a little bit about how that's broken down.
May I say something first?
Sure.
Diana Ross brought Michael Jackson into the studio when Motown came to Los Angeles. This was 1969, mm-hmm. and they hadn't moved from Detroit yet. And Diana came out here when Michael came in the studio with her, and he was 11, and he was just this most amazing person. We all looked at him, and he was like magnetic. He was just dynamic. And Freddie Perren and Deke Richards and Fonts Mazzell were called the Corporation. Barry Gordy, I liked everybody to write in threes. So it was like a Holland Dozier Holland. This was this was Fonts Mazzell and Freddie Perren and Deke Richards. And Freddie Perren wrote out this amazing arrangement, which we're about to listen to. I'm going to just preface it. This is what happened. There was a piano glissando on beat four, so it's one, two, three, boom. Louis Shelton. He's playing the A flat in octaves.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Wilton Felder come in. David T. Walker. So we were the three guitars, and So now when you listen to it, just remember it's Louis Shelton and me, and then you've got David T. Go ahead.
Okay, here is the clip.
Watch your back. Hey, Lori's jumping around on this TV.
No, it's really interesting. And what one of the things I wanted to talk about is how these sections compared to doing the Wrecking Crew, because you have the three guitars,
right,
which were common during the Wrecking Crew times.
Actually,
too.
The Wrecking Crew was more like five or six guitars.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay. But and also, too, the bass is melodic, and it's more prominent than in most songs.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, with Phil... You know, with Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound, we usually had three bass players. We had an upright bass, we had an electric bass, a Fender, what they call a precision bass, we call it a P bass. And plus, we had Carol Kay, who was playing a Dan Electro six-string bass guitar. So the bass would be played with these three different instruments, which are very different in sound, but they blend together. And the reason we had so many guitar players was Phil wanted this... I don't know how to explain it. I want to say mush, but that's not a word, is it? he wanted us all to blend together, and he would rehearse us for 6 hours. He would make us so tired that by the time he rolled it, we were just blending. You know, we were just playing the song.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that, of course, is River Deep Mountain High, Ike and Tina Turner, which was Phil's last great recording and our last Wall of Sound recording. And it was just... an amazing record. It was big in the UK, was not big over here. But like when we did The Righteous Brothers, you know, you lost that loving feeling. If you want to go there, or do you want to stay with Motown for now?
We can go there, and then we'll go back because we have plenty of Motown
stuff. I'll tell you two interesting things about Bill Medley with that wonderful deep voice. When the disc jockeys, first of all, these records were 45 RPM, so they had two sides. Well, in order to prevent the disc jockeys from discovering side B, he would have instrumentals on the backside.
Right, I remember.
So, and Bill Medley, when he first starts, you know, he says, "You'll never close your eyes," and then we start. And I'll talk to you more about that technique, but the DJs thought it was at the wrong speed. They were like, "Whoa, this must be, you know, what's wrong with this record?" And then, of course, the band would come in and they'd figure it out.
But, that's right. His voice was
oh boy.
Low for us.
So if you don't mind playing "Loving Feeling," I was so proud to be on that record.
Here, let me play a little bit of that.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips, and there's no tenderness like grief in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby, baby, I know.
Now, it's interesting there, too. The you can hear that six-string bass.
Yes, ding, doom, ding, doom, ding, doom. Ding, ding. Yeah, that's Carole Kaye.
That's great. But what I wanted to ask you was, in the Wall of Sound,
right?
How were the guitar? You had three guitar players, right? Or more than that.
The Wall of Sound was five.
Five guitar players. So what was? How was that divvied up?
Okay.
And how did that work? How did he put that? I mean,
okay, here's what he did. It was unison. It wasn't divvied up.
Okay.
It was Barney Kessel and Howard Roberts and Tommy Tedesco and Bill Pittman, Dennis Budimir, and me, and we were all doing the same thing.
I know Bill.
I'm sorry?
I know Bill. He's great.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And this was the magic of it, was the fact that we played together. And, in fact, I found out later, this Larry Levine revealed to us later, that there weren't enough inputs in the board for that many microphones. So they would mult them up. They would put, like, three guitars into one channel.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd all, and, you know, we were recording mono at first, and then got to be stereo.
Well, that's another thing, too. I would think that that was one of the reasons he had everybody, because there was, he didn't have to overdub.
Exactly.
Everybody there.
Everybody was there. And, but this thing, this strumming thing, the thing about it is Phil would go to the piano players, and he would say, look, Michelle Rubini and Don Randy, and he would say, look, I want you to play the chord in both hands, and I want you to roll your fingers so that you're actually rolling the chord, you're arpeggiating it, and, but in time, da 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 da, and they had us, and I'm going to play this in a little different key because my guitar's not tuned down there, but if it's, that's the style that we played for Phil, and that was that rolling strum thing that made that sound, that Wall of Sound.
Wow. It's interesting how that... Now, let's go back to the Motown thing. Where you, now, let's look at the song that we just played, I Want You Back.
Right.
You have the three guitars, but they're doing parts against each other.
Absolutely. Well, I wouldn't say against.
But I mean, like counterpunnel.
Yeah. Yes, counterpunnel.
Because one's like doing a little fill here, and then you're doing the run. Right. How much of that was written?
The line I played, the... that was written out, and I read that, and Wilton read it in octaves.
Okay.
And we played it very tight. You can hear how tight that is.
Mm-hmm.
David T. was improvising. That was his idea. Louis Shelton was reading this one.
That was written out.
Yeah.
Wow. And who did the arrangements for those?
Freddie Perren. He was a genius. Freddie Perren was an amazing man and a wonderful human being.
Now, what guitar? Do you remember what you were using on that song?
Based on the time period, I think it was the red guitar that I used for Let's Get It On.
And that was a Gibson?
That was the Barney Kessel.
The Barney Kessel. So that was a Barney Kessel.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I got the black Lucille in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So I used that on most of the rest of the records.
And then what kind of amp did you use? Just a Fender?
No, it was a twin reverb.
Twin reverb.
With tubes, you know, of course. Valves, they say in England.
And then how was that, Mike, compared to, like, you know, how were you set up in the studio as opposed to the Wall of Sound? Was there enough channels? Were you all separated? Or what was it? How were you guys situated?
That was a very funny story. I'm glad you asked that question. Motown, in order to save money, Ben Barrett was the contractor, Benjamin Barrett, and we all had our own amplifiers, and we all each had a trunk the size of this desk filled with guitars, and we had a guy, Royal Cartage, and they would bring the trunk to the session and bring in your amp, and then you'd come in and play, and then they would grab your stuff and race to the next studio for the next session, and they came to Ben Barrett, and they said, Ben, you know, what are these bills for Cartage? Ben said, well, that's, you know, for carrying the equipment, and they said, well, wait a minute. So they had their engineer build a box, and it had six plugs on it. And we came in the studio, and they said, leave your amps outside, guys. And they had each of us plug into this box, and each one had a volume control. So now we start rehearsing, and David T. reaches down and turns his up a little bit. And I'm trying to hear myself, and I'm like, I'm going to, and I turn myself up. Well, then Wawa Watson reaches down and turns his up. It was a war.
So that would just go direct?
Yes, it was going direct.
Oh, okay.
But then that they abandoned that because we were starting to fight with each other. It was not a good situation.
Yeah, well, and also, too, did it sound okay?
It sounded thin. You know, it sounded cheesy, as they say in the business. That's a technical word. Yeah, it wasn't my sound. My sound was through an amp, and they used an SM57, of, you know, Shure 57, mm-hmm. was the go-to mic
right.
to mic guitar amps.
Right. The other guys, David and Louie, were they using Gibsons primarily, or did they use Fenders?
You know, that's a very good question. David T. played a Gibson, and I'm not sure about Louie Sheldon. The Wawa Watson, I think he played a Gibson.
Okay.
And Ray Parker Jr.
Because it's interesting, that sound of that guitar would affect... You know, I know, like, Tommy and the Wrecking Crew used a Tele a lot.
Yes, he did. He did.
And they
He hated that guitar.
Really?
There was one day the producer came out, and, you know, they're always striving. It's like a director. You know, he wants to blow things up. The producer comes out to Tommy, and he says, Tommy, listen, man, I want you to make a sound with this guitar that has never been made before. And the whole band is going, uh-oh. So we're playing through the song, and we get to the place where it's supposed to happen, and Tommy threw the Telecaster up in the air, and it hit the floor and broke into a million pieces and made that noise, and the guy loved it.
Yeah, that was the Michael Nesmith album.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wichita Chain, you can hear it, because
yes.
you hear the session player saying, Tommy's gone crazy, Tommy's gone crazy, and they're all laughing.
Listen.
Yeah, that's a classic. That's a classic story. I remember that.
I got to arrange a bunch of those for the Monkees. Mike Nesmith and I worked together. And we did Mary Mary and Gonna Buy Me a Dog, Sweet Young Thing, You May Just Be the One, and a couple of others.
For the Monkees or for his solo?
For the
solo?
Monkees. The Monkees when I was arranging for them.
Oh, okay. Did you get to play on the Monkee sessions?
A little bit. Mostly I was directing.
Directing. That's great. Well, let's play another clip. I'm going to play the other big hit there are so many for the Jackson 5, but ABC. And it's interesting. I was listening to it because... I don't remember on listening on radio when I first heard it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear everything, but listening now when I was playing the clip, there's a fuzz tone in it.
Yes, yes, and this was in the very beginning of fuzz tones. There was a thing called the Rat, which was a little black box,
mm-hmm.
distortion box, and there was one other thing, and those were the very primitive guitar distortion devices, and it sounds a little cheesy, actually.
It's that classic fuzz from the
classic. You see, there's a word, classic.
Yeah, it is. It's a distinctive sound of the time.
Yeah.
But were you doing the fuzz?
I must have been because that's my part. I go down. Everybody else is going, and then I do the.
Yeah, that's the line that I heard.
Yeah.
Okay, this is in the middle of the song, but you'll hear that line. I was trying to bring out the guitar.
Right.
There's the fuzz tone, and then there's two of you harmonizing, and you were an overdubbing. So who was playing the other guitar?
Probably Louie Sheldon.
And then the kind of the rhythm thing. I'm trying to remember this what they called that style. It's not skanking, but it was like there's a little rhythm guy up there.
I'm not sure.
Would that be David?
I'm not sure.
But I noticed that line, I got it where it was clean on this where this part of the clip,
mm-hmm.
and then you go in and you do the fuzz tone. But that's a classic fuzz tone.
Yeah.
Was that a rat? Was that a
probably,
rat?
Probably. It's probably, you know, it's been a while.
Because mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, what year, that was 1970?
71, 72.
Oh, yeah, there were several out by then.
Yeah.
So It's hard to tell which. A lot of the British guys were using the fuzz face and the tone bender.
Sure. And it could have been a tone bender, come to think of it.
Could have been a tone bender?
Yeah, it could have been.
So, but that's an interesting sound. And then, again, what I'm noticing from the traditional Wrecking Crew type of thing where everybody's playing together, you guys are playing different parts and different things. And this one was kind of cool because it's like a double lead thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, later on in the later 70s, you heard it more in a lot of the rock groups.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, you didn't hear that much cup of harmony like that as much. And I thought that was, that's kind of interesting. Also, too, there were no overdubs, right? You guys were recording.
It was pretty much into the multi-track. By the way, I have to say something about multi-track recording. Okay. When I was playing with Phil Spector, and we were doing the Wall of Sound, and the Wrecking Crew, there were a lot of really nice people, guys that we were friends with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were recording mono or two-track right. or maybe four-track. Well, suddenly, they wheeled in these great big tape recorders with 24 separate channels. So each of us had our own channel. So now, all of a sudden, they could listen. When I'm driving home, they could push the solo button and listen, what did Don do for 3.5 minutes without stopping? So now some of these guys started disappearing because although they were good guys, they were friendly, but they could not play for 3.5 minutes. You know, they couldn't do it. So they became ex-Wrecking Crew members.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but you know what? Do you remember Sheffield Records?
Yeah.
Do you know about direct-to-disc, Laurie? Okay, well, Lincoln Mayorga and Doug Sachs,
yes.
the mastering lab.
Lab, yeah.
They decided they were going to bring in the band, and they were going to put a piece of vinyl on the lathe, and they were going to record an album. So that meant we had to sit down with six songs, because each side had six songs, and we had to play them perfectly, because there was no stopping. So that's what we did. And then they would take off and put a second piece of vinyl and record the backside. And these records are worth a bunch of money.
Actually, to give a little more background about it, originally, when radio shows were done, like, you know, you have all the different orchestras that were on during old-time radio, they would cut directly to lathe. So they would literally cut the record there live. So all these programs, like Bob Hope during World War II or after World War II, they would record all these shows. And that's those transcriptions are where you get your old radio shows. Radio dramas were all done live. And they literally, you couldn't stop. You just went for 20 minutes or whatever it was on the disc, and that was it. And that's what Sheffield Labs, they found that the direct-to-disc without using tape, there was no compression. So you could get the dynamic range on a record is much higher than tape, so you'd get a more authentic. It was like the ultimate audiophile thing.
Right.
And Doug Sachs and Mayorga were really into that. And so that's what they did. And I remember Dave Grusin did a record because Lee Ritenour was on, and he was telling us about that. And if they made a mistake, they had to go back and do the whole set. Yeah,
that's right. And then also made you not too popular with your fellow players, you know, if you're the one.
And I mean, like the Dave Grusin record, that was some monster stuff. It was all written out, and it was tight. And those guys nailed it. And it was they said that separated the men from the boys in terms of recording.
It totally did.
But yeah, that was that type of lot. Well, that's what you guys were experiencing then. But then, so you were was the Jackson 5 stuff multi-track?
Yes, it was. It was 24 track.
Oh, okay. So they would record you live, but they separated you guys on tracks.
They separated us on tracks, and then they, of course, mixed it all together.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I wanted to ask you, too, is a little bit, we were talking a little bit before the show, is you mentioned that originally Motown was in Detroit.
Correct.
That's where the term Motor City or Motortown came from, but they moved to L.A., and then there was the L.A. Motown.
Right.
Was there any difference in terms of the sound?
Yes, there was a big difference. Benjamin Barrett was asked by Berry Gordy to get together a band, and they called me and said, you know, would you be a staff player for Motown? And I said, absolutely, yes, sure. And they hired David T., and they hired Gene Pello to play drums, and Wilton Felder from the Crusaders, Joe Sample from the Crusaders. And it was very, very different. The guys in Detroit, first of all, were older than we were, Mm-hmm. Secondly, they were dyed-in-the-wool jazz guys who played at night, who went out and played, and then they'd come in Motown studio, and they made up. One more time. Those kind of things are genius. I mean, those guys came up with extraordinary parts. And Motown put out a record called Standing in the Shadow of Motown. And they also made a karaoke album of Motown hits without the singers. And so you could really hear the band. And you hear, you know, like Johnny Griffith. He was playing out there. He was playing very strange things on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of Marvin and what's going on, it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys were really out there. The guys in Los Angeles, we're kind of what they call a West Coast sound. I can't explain it. Yeah, we play jazz out here, but it's different. And there was always that conversation about East Coast jazz and West Coast jazz, you know, yeah. Chet Baker and all that, and Miles. But so definitely the players out here were different.
Well, I know that the ones from Detroit, the section for all the Motown hits were called the Funk Brothers.
Correct.
But you guys still had that kind of funky feel to it.
Oh, yeah, we're funky.
And you know, that wasn't common. I mean, like, the Wrecking Crew wasn't doing that kind of music at that time. I mean, it wasn't the R&B feel. Everybody would assume it was a Chicago thing or back east or something
right. Like
that. But you guys were doing that.
Well, we were tremendously versatile. I mean, all of us could do so many different styles and do them well. And not just dabble, but really nail it. And, you know, it's like I was with Ray Charles for all those years. And one of the things he liked about me was my time and the fact that, you know, I could play the time without moving. Because as we were speaking about before we started, in the dance band, the rhythm guitar is a very important part of the percussion.
Yeah, well, in a jazz band, mm-hmm. the guitar is the timekeeper, not the drums, which is... Today, with fusion and contemporary,
right.
The drum still is the main beat, because with rock and pop, that's
sure.
a strong thing. But in real jazz, you're the guy keeping it together, and the drummer's doing all the hits.
The hits, yeah, with the brass.
Yeah. Well, actually, since we're talking about that, let's play a clip from that. And I found this. Now, it's going to be hard. You got to listen. This is a very old recording, and the fidelity isn't that good. But I was trying to find Ray Charles when the era when he played, when there was this big band, because later on he kind of, after you had played with him, he did do the big band again. But a lot of the stuff, there is a lot of stuff with the small ensemble.
Right.
But I wanted to show you with the band, because to be honest with you, that band really rocked. That was a great band. Let me
tell you about that band. We had half of Count Basie's band and half of Duke Ellington's orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Tizol was playing trombone, who wrote Perdido. Philip Gilbo was playing the jazz chair. He was from Basie's band. These guys were unbelievable. Fathead Newman, James Clay, Fred Morrell, Edgar Willis played bass. It was unbelievable. And I was the only white guy. And
yeah.
It was stunning. Imagine, and Ray would keep me up front near him. So behind me were four trumpets, four trombones, and five saxes, and you could smell the valve oil blowing through the trumpets. I mean, it was... Well, listen to this. Listen to this.
Okay, band. I'm going to play a clip. This is Alexander's Ragtime Band. Listen to this arrangement. It's dynamite.
Come on! Come on!
Come on in here, the best band in the land. They can play a few of all like you never heard before. Don't have to run out to one of the walls. It's just the best in band forever. Oh, honey lamb, come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand to meet the man, to meet the man. Who's the leader of the band? And if you want to hear that funny rhythm, play it in the right time. Oh, come on, yeah. Come on, yeah. Come on, yeah.
come on and give that one. Kill each other and nothing.
So now you know what Don was doing every night. Those guys were cooking, but can hear how the drums were doing the hits with some of the brass or whatever, and he's doing all these really cool hits, but it's still tight, and that's you. You don't hear you as much, but you feel it. That's the way when I was taught by Duke, when I was talking to Duke, because he did a lot of big band stuff for the Universal Pictures.
Sure.
And he said that you don't hear it, you feel it.
That's right.
It's like, but it keeps it together. If you took the guitar out, you'd notice it. So what would you be doing in a thing like that?
Well, first of all, Freddie Green was my idol. He played with Basie. Mm-hmm. Freddie Green, rather than playing an entire chord, look at my hand for a second, instead of playing a full bar A flat with a flat string, okay, Freddie Green would play root, seventh, and third. So it would be. That's how you play rhythm guitar for big band.
So that was root.
And then seventh.
Seventh.
And then third.
And third.
Yeah, so A flat, G flat.
Well, what I'm hearing too also is the fact that you're only playing the three notes, it cuts more. If you played the full bar chord, it's too much. It's
right.
Too full.
Right.
That way you're getting, so it actually cut more. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually do that rhythm with the full bar chord and then go to the three notes.
Okay. So here's a full bar.
Okay.
Full chord. See, I immediately went to the Freddie Green.
Okay. So now do the three note. So you can hear, I mean,
yeah.
Him by him with Don playing by himself, it's a nice full sound with the full, but in context with the rest of the band, it might get a little muddy.
Yeah, on my guitar, I had a 1936 L5, which I still have, and these guitars were made to play with a dance band without an amplifier.
Now, that L5 didn't have any pickups, right?
No, it's an acoustic guitar.
Totally acoustic, just no pickups on it at all.
Archtop F-hole guitar.
And what do? They just mic'd you?
No.
You were just playing acoustically.
I could be heard over the entire band. It's just an amazing guitar. I'll show it to you sometime.
Now, you have to bring that next time. Yeah. That's a classic.
Yeah, that's on Loving Feeling, too, that guitar.
Oh, the L5?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that, by the way, going back to Phil Spector, Barney had an L5, I had an L5, Bill Pittman had an L5. It was a row of Gibson L5s, because that was the sound. And the archtop guitars were very different from the round hole guitars.
Right. Well, it sounds... It gave it a little bit of a. It wasn't as much of those were out without pickups, right? When you were doing that,
all acoustic, but they were mic'd, of course. In that case,
they were mic'd. Yeah, but I mean that's the thing. The pickup gave you that deeper, which we know now more for the jazz,
right?
That kind of bluesier type of deep sound. But these, well, even this guitar without the pickups when you're playing, because we're not really hearing the amp right now, and it just cuts.
Yeah, it's a great instrument. 1948. Gibson ES-350 with a single dog ear pickup.
Yeah, and that, those arch tops really cut. It's a different, a lot of people today, because of pop music and stuff, they're looking at acoustic guitars like Martins, which are the Dreadnought or the OM series, and it's a deeper sound. It's a deeper thing, whereas this is, it's not meant to be that deep. It's meant to cut. It function is as a percussion.
You can finger pick it.
it's got a nice sound. Well, that's a great sounding guitar anyway, but I mean the but it's interesting that a lot of stuff too, it's that the in those early songs you would think at the time, because you know most electric guitars we were thinking at that time were Fenders, you're using the Gibsons, but it's not like the later ones, like where you're using the 335s and right. stuff like that, right. which the sound changed. And the LA sound, which eventually, like Larry Carlton made a stigma or made it what it is today, is that sound with the humbuckers.
Absolutely.
So, but so it was acoustic, so there was no amps. You guys on Lost That Loving Feeling, there were no amps on there.
Nope.
Now, did you ever use acoustic guitar on the in any of the Motown stuff? Like use the jazz guitar like that?
Not really. I did have a full body Gibson guitar. It wasn't this guitar, mm-hmm. but it had two pickups, and it was bright gold color. I remember that, and I used that on a couple of Motowns. But don't forget, I also had some other instruments. I had a Coral electric sitar, which was my pride and joy. I should never have sold it. And it had a set of sympathetic strings across it, like the real sitars, mm-hmm. as well as the normal strings. And then there was a piece of ebony that the strings went across, which made it go boing. Do you mind playing the Michael Jackson?
Okay,
which one? This is Maybe Tomorrow.
Maybe Tomorrow.
I was always very proud of this. It's kind of obscure, but it's a lovely song, and I'm featured, of course, which makes me very happy.
Okay, here's the Jackson by Maybe Tomorrow. That's just a great sound. That's a really cool sound.
Should never have sold that.
What year was that?
It was in the 70s. I'm not sure. But in 1974, I went to Ray Charles and I said, listen, Brother Ray, I said, you know, I got to ask you this. I said, I'm sorry, but a lot of the other people are putting my names on the records, you know, putting all of our band, and you don't put us on your records. And he said, listen, Don, he said, you know, the people don't want to know who's playing. They buy on my records. They don't want to know who the band is. And I said, you know, Ray, I said, I really don't like this, and I'm going to have to stop playing. And I called Ben Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ben, I said, listen, I've decided I'm going to be an arranger, and I'm going to stop playing these dates because the record producers would not take me seriously as an arranger if I was a guitar player. Tom Scott was the first one to break through and be an instrumentalist. And, you know, so I stopped playing in 74.
Kind of funny because, you know, you would think an instrumentalist would know how to arrange because he plays.
That's especially, right.
And an example, Tom Scott, who's a horn player and he is a sax player, and he would, you know, he's playing with those guys all the time.
That's right.
But I always thought that there were a lot of guitar players that were brilliant arrangers.
Yeah, Tony Mottola in the old days. There were a lot, but for some reason I decided, I made this, you know, idea that I was going to be arranging. Because I was playing with Bobby Darin at the Coconut Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And Darin said, listen, I want you to come on the road with me. And I said, Bobby, I want to stay in L.A. I want to be an arranger. He said, can you arrange? I said, well, I did some charts when I was out with Ray Charles, but I never recorded anything. And he said, okay. A week later, my phone rings, and a voice says, this is Charles Koppelman from Koppelman Rubin. Mr. Darin wants you to arrange his new hit, his new single. So I said, okay. So I go down to the office, and these two gentlemen are in suits, and the loudspeakers are up on the wall. I'd never seen that before. And they played me this amazing, wonderful song called If I Were a Carpenter, Tim Hardin. And they said, we want to keep the timbales. We like that. We want you to write strings for this. So I got my yellow pad. I'm writing, you know. I said, okay, strings. In the meantime, inside, I'm dying because I never wrote for strings before. So I leave there. I race to my house. I open all the books. And I start figuring out how to write for strings. So a week later, we're at Gold Star Studios. And I've got Sid Sharp, concertmaster. I've got Jesse Ehrlich playing cello. Gary Nettacombe playing viola. I can't remember the second violinist. Bob West on bass, Hal Blaine on drums, Dennis Budimir on guitar, David Cohen. I met with David, and there's this 12-string part at the beginning, and we got that together. And so lo and behold, we started, you know, and of course I'm scared to death. So I start backing away from the band towards the door, and I'm going, one, two, one, two. And they start playing, and, you know, it's, you know, this, you know... You know, and all of a sudden the strings came in, and it sounded pretty good. So I came back in the room, and then Darren said, "Listen, Don," he said, "you know, I want you to play on this too." So I ended up, I was the guitar going, I was in it. That was me, and it became a hit record for Bobby Darin.
That's amazing. Yeah. Now, how many string players were in it?
It was a string quartet.
Just a quartet that played on there. And now, when you were writing for that, were you, you're thinking guitar-wise, so you were...
No, I was using the piano.
Oh, you did it on the piano. Oh, okay.
And Don Everly really influenced me. Don Everly would do this Cajun tuning with a guitar where it was in fifths. Mm-hmm. So you didn't hear the third of the chord. And it really influenced me. And if you look at the string parts... You see that there was never a third. It was only root and fifth.
That's amazing. That's a great sound. That's really good. Now, I want to go back real quick to Ray Charles, what you were talking about, because we talked about the function of the guitar in big band.
Right.
But Ray also did other songs that were more pop songs.
Mm-hmm. And country songs.
And country songs. So... How did your guitar play? What did you... I mean, how did that work out? Because...
Well, I was lead guitar with the Everly Brothers for 3 years.
Okay.
61, 62, and 63. So until the Everlys stopped playing at that point, and then I came back to L.A., and then I got hired by Ray. So I was very familiar with country. And the band leader, when I was playing in college, I left engineering school, and I got into the music school. Mm-hmm. And I was hired by Lance LaGault. Now, he pronounced it LaGault, because he's Canadian, French-Canadian. But Lance LaGault... was a stand-in for Elvis in the movies. So we were at the Crossbow, which is at Van Nuys Boulevard, way, way up north. And Elvis would come in about three times a week, and Dorsey Burnett and Jerry Burnett were with him. Mm-hmm. And they'd go up in the balcony, and we would, on our breaks, we'd sit up in the balcony and hang out with Elvis. And he would go, "Hello, Don." And I was 19 years old, and he was this lovely, lovely guy. So Lance loved Ray Charles. And Lance learned every Ray Charles song, and we had to play them perfectly. So when I did my audition for Ray Charles, and Ray said, "Listen, we've lost some of the music. Do you know Hallelujah, I'll Ever So?" And I said, "Of course I do." And I played it for him. I played it perfectly. And Ray said, you know, they really were like looking for someone who knew the old songs. And then Ray sat at the piano, and he did the, you know, the... He went, you know... I didn't do anything. I was just sitting there, and then you know, he did, and then he went, you know, he started in with the
what I'd say,
and I went, and Ray started laughing. No guitar player had ever done that. They always just went, you know, and Ray hired me right on the spot. But there was a problem, because I said, "Well, how much does it?" Joe Adams came over and said, "You know, I want to hire you." And I said, "Well, how much does it pay?" And Joe Adams said, "We pay $200 a week." And I said, "Well, Mr. Adams," I said, "you know, I just got off the road with the Everly Brothers, and they pay $225. And Joe Adams said, "Well, I'm going to have to talk to Ray about this." So I leave, and I'm going down the steps, and I'm thinking, what in the world? Did I just turn down Ray Charles? Oh, my God. You know, well, the time I got to my house, my mother came outside. She said, "Joe Adams called. It's cool." we're going to give you a separate envelope with 25 so the rest
yeah,
of
the guys on.
But I mean, I couldn't believe I did that.
But now you were using the L5 acoustic, but when you were doing the other songs,
I used Blondie. This guitar.
You had that guitar by the time you, so you had the pickup, and then what kind of amp at that time?
A Fender Twin.
You still had the Twin, so that's what you would.
Yeah.
So you'd move around. You would use both.
Yeah. Yeah, the guitar, the L5 was so distinctive, and it was so perfect with a big band, and it was great fun.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, but before we go, I do want you to play that other guitar and tell us the story behind that.
Okay.
The black one.
All right. Let me hand over this guitar. I'm going to unplug this.
He has a Gibson, and it looks like an ES-335, but there's more to the story. And I'll let Don explain, because this is a beautiful guitar, but you will not believe what it originally was.
Don't go away.
Okay, he's putting it on right, and it's got gold hardware on it. It's a beautiful instrument. Okay, and I'm going to take a couple pictures while you're talking about it. Okay, here we got a shot of that. So, briefly, give us a little story about how you got this guitar.
Okay, this guitar was red, and it was a 12-string guitar, and it was John Phillips from the Mamas and Papas. And I knew a man, a luthier, named Paul Herman. And he said to me, Don, listen, I've got this guitar. I'm converting it to a 6-string. And if you look carefully at the head, you can actually see the extra holes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a 12, and the head was bigger. But he cut it down. So this guitar has this incredible sustain because the neck is heavier because it was made to be a 12-string. It's painted black at this point, and it is not fresh looking anymore. It has scratches, and it's... You know, I've been using it on all these records and playing it live, but...
We call it, it has character.
Character! Ah! So, but this guitar... It's just... The sustain is like... Or, you know... Yeah, it's just...
Now, when did you get this guitar?
1970.
You didn't use this on the Jacksons, or did you?
I did. I did on the later records. After Let's Get It On, I got rid. The guitar had a very thin neck, and I really liked this guitar. So
it's got a great sound.
Oh, you know, yeah, but it has this wonderful, you know, Motown.
I love it. It's great. You don't know what year that is, or do you?
It's a 1968.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And it has, it's got a good long neck, and it has, but it's also got a lot of spacing. This is the way to play.
Now, is that a longer scale because of the 12 string? So it is a...
So when you got that kind of a seventh, it's a bit of a reach.
It's got a great sound. It's a really mellow sound.
Yeah. I love this guitar. I call it Lucille, even though BB's guitar... May I tell you a quick story about BB and Ray Charles?
Sure, sure.
I was taken backstage to meet BB King after one of his shows at one of the great, huge Indian casinos. And I was introduced to BB, and they said, "This is Don Peake. He's Ray Charles' guitar player." And BB grabbed my hand, and he put my hand against his heart, and he said, "Don, man," he said, "you're scaring me now." He said, "We're not easy to play for Ray Charles." And he said, "Let me tell you a story about Brother Ray." Because Ray liked to do those funny country songs.
Mm-hmm.
So Ray had called BB down to the studio, and they were in Ray's office, and he told BB, he said, "Listen, B, I want to do this country song." And B said, "I don't know that song." And Ray Charles said, "Don't worry, I've had somebody type out the words for you." And BB King looked at Ray, and he said, "Can you do me a favor?" And Ray said, "What's that?" He said, "Do you mind turning the lights on?" Because Ray always kept his office dark. So that's my BB King story.
It's amazing the he did. I was looking at a lot of the different stuff that he did. He did a lot of different things back then.
Well, we did songs like "Granny Wasn't Grinning That Day," mm-hmm. and all this crazy. Ray came out of the booth one day and he yelled my name, and the whole band was there, and Jack Halloran's singers were gathered around. And he comes up to me, he goes, Don, he says, listen, he goes, dabba doo ba doo do dat and do dat, dabba doo ba doo be doo. So I went, this is it. I can't do it right now. Lori's looking at me, I can't do it. Anyway, and so we did that, we recorded that song, Blue Moon Over Kentucky.
Blue Moon Over.
Yeah.
Now, I heard in the big band thing, and I'm going to play a clip to take us out. There's an organ in there too, or did
Billy Preston?
That was Billy Preston.
You betcha!
Wow.
Oh yeah, we had an amazing group.
Wow, Billy Preston. So did he? He always played the organ, or did Ray do the?
Ray sometimes did. I have to listen to the record, but America the Beautiful. It's Billy Preston playing the organ.
Right. Wow. Yeah. So who else was it? Who played when you toured? Billy Preston played organ.
Not on the tours.
He
recorded with us. Van Trees played organ on the tours.
Okay.
And Edgar Willis played bass. And later on, Peter Turi played drums. When I joined the band, it was Wilbert Hogan. Do we have time for a quick Wilbert Hogan story?
Sure.
Wilbert Hogan was a very, very serious drummer. Serious jazz drummer. And one night, we're getting ready for the show. And the promoter comes up to Hogan. He says, listen, we've got a comedian tonight. I want you to come out on stage, and I want you to play some pratfalls. And Hogan walked right up to him, and he put his toes against his toes, and he put his nose against his nose, and he said, I don't play no circus drums. And the promoter walked away. We never saw that guy again.
But he would have been the guy that's in 65.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's him.
That's Hogan.
And we'll hear him in a couple of seconds that was doing all those great fills. We're out of time.
Okay.
Which means you have to come back because we got to cover. We should cover the more on like the Bobby Darin and get into your arrangements and stuff.
Sure.
So you definitely have to come back and at the very least bring the L5 back.
I will.
You got to bring the L5. I want to see that guitar.
Okay, I promise.
I want to thank Lori for putting this together and introducing you to Don. But also, too, you have any announcements? What's going on?
So just two quick things. One is this weekend for L.A. people, Sunday evening at Vitello's upstairs at the eSpot Lounge. I'm hosting a songwriter night featuring four great singer-songwriters, Gary Stockdale, and actually Grant Geisman will be with him, who's been on this show before. Mm-hmm. Gia Kembati, Steve Postel, who's been on this show before.
And has come back.
And Charlie Baker. Yeah, Steve is coming back too. And Charlie Baker from Ojai. And then the other show that I wanted to mention and will continue to mention is a fundraising event that we're doing at Bogey's for Jerry Donahue, who suffered from a massive stroke last year. And so many of his great guitar player friends are going to be on stage that night. Freebo will be hosting, and Albert Lee, Lawrence Juber, Carl Verheyen, and John Jorgensen, and Peter Asher, and Jeff Allen Ross is going to be musical producer for that one, musical director, and we want to raise some money. And those people who cannot attend it, they can give. You're going to be posting it, so just
check. It was posted today, and it'll be posting every other day.
The website or on the Facebook page, and you'll see the link. To either get tickets or to follow up and be able to make donations directly to Jerry Donahue.
Thank you for putting that together. That's a great.
And then what are you up to?
My group is called Generations of Soul, and we are right now, if you go to www.generationsofsoul.com, right now there's just a poster up from our concert at Bogey's, but our video should be up later this week, our EPK. And we are getting ready to go on tour. Lamont Dozier Jr., son of Holland Dozier Holland from Motown. Beth Griffith, daughter of Johnny Griffith, Motown Funk Brothers. And it's an amazing band. We sound, you know, there's a lot of people trying to play Motown, but not a lot of people can really play it.
Yeah.
And we play it.
That's great. Well, I'm going to leave us with Let the Good Times Roll.
Oh, yeah.
This is again from 1965. And in the back there, you got to listen real quick, but you'll hear you playing back there. But I want to thank you again.
My pleasure.
We will have you back for sure. And thank you, Lori. Everybody, let the good times roll.
I want you back.
When you're dead, you're done. So let the good times roll. Whoa, let them roll, baby. I don't care if you're young or old. Get yourself together, let the good times roll, baby. Don't sit there mumbling, talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you gotta go out and spend some cash. And let the good times roll, baby. Let them roll. I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together, let the good time roll, baby.